dinner and the festivities that we call. But I know it's pretty cramped here, and those who can salute the flag will have to half salute, flag salute. Those that can't, well, do it in place. And then we'll have John Chabot, the chaplain, give the opening prayer, and then we'll be ready for serving. We'll get the amenities off the way. And salute. John, the opening prayer.
Heavenly Father, we ask that thy blessing may rest upon us as we gather here for this meeting. May our deliberations have thy divine guidance, and may we now and in the days of to come, we dedicate our organization and ourselves to the advancement of our sacred ideals, ever remembering that the veterans of all services is for God and country. Direct us so that we may perform our duties faithfully and efficiently and abundantly. Bless us all forever. Amen.
Amen. At the end of the meal, donation. The Japanese shot down. He was a darkness, Dr. Stoneman's dive bomber pilot, the second in war, and he was shot down under the ball and taken captive and held for the duration of the war. In fact, a little longer because American forces bypassed the island that Joe was held on, so they were released later. And I understand that under 63 of the captives, only six were alive when American forces liberated. Of course, later on, Joe joined the Peace Corps with his wife, and they went to the Marianas. He'll have, I've left it open for him to talk, and speak on any subject or anything you wish to. So, thank you, Joe.
About my life. And so, if that's what you'd perhaps like to hear, I'll tell you a little. First of all, a few bare facts. As Merrill said, there were 63 of us, and only seven of us got out. I went in weighing 210, and I got out weighing 80. I should start by saying I got shot down. I was a Navy pilot, but at the time we were sort of ran out of carriers. Most of our carriers were sunk and the new ones hadn't quite got out there. So I was based on an island in the Solomons. I got shot down over Bougainville, and when I got shot down, I was dive bombing an airstrip, and the anti-aircraft hit me, and I came down in flames, and you don't think twice about jumping out when you're burning up. And my rear seat man was a very nice guy from Worcester, a kid named Tommy Furlong. And Tommy, I guess, got hit with the same shell that hit the plane because he never got out. I came right down over the airstrip, and they were shooting tracers at me, and bombs were going off down below. But I pulled a few shrouds here and there, as they told us. And anyway, the parachute drifted off the field, came down some trees, and sort of lightly went down on the ground because the trees broke my fall. And I got up and started running like a rabbit or a deer. I was, you know, really panicky. And I ran until I got a cramp, and then I thought, geez, I might be running right into the Japs. So I took cover and got under a log and thought, maybe if I can wait this out till nightfall, I got a chance. And this is what I'm going to tell you a little about is you go from despair to hope. Well, all of a sudden I had hope. I thought, geez, I used to do a lot of hunting and fishing. I've been in the woods all my life. Maybe I can get out of this place. And so I waited till night, and I figured out which way was south. I started to head for the coast, which was about 150 miles off, the southern coast. Thought if I could steal a native canoe or make a raft, I could get out in the ocean, and maybe the Americans would see me. At that time, the Japs, there were 30,000 Japs in Bougainville and no Americans. Now, you might say, why? There were a couple of coast watches, but they never told us where they were, for obvious reasons. If the Japs would have tortured us and found out where the coast watches were, I suppose what I should have done is tried to find a native. Maybe the natives would have taken me to the coast watches. But at any rate, I made my way through the jungles for several days, and I still had hope that I could get to the shore. I ran into the Japs a couple of times, but I was able to avoid them. And I was getting quite confident, but getting quite hungry, because I didn't find anything to eat for a whole week. And all of a sudden, I came around a bend. I was probably getting weaker. I had the fever. And I ran right into a Jap with a rifle. And at that point, you know, I said, surrender. my 45 had snapped off when I jumped, so I didn't have too much choice. And so all of a sudden, from hope, I went back to despair. And at that time, we didn't know too much about the Japs, except from Guadalcanal. And all we knew from Guadalcanal is they didn't take any prisoners, and the Marines didn't take any prisoners. You know, they fought for the death. And we'd seen pictures prominently in American newspapers of some poor pilot that got shot down in the Philippines with a Jap with a samurai sword about to cut his head off. So that's what I figured, you know, that was coming to me. And so they took my watch and they threw my medicine up in the air and they laughed and joked. There were quite a group of them there. But then they took me back to their camp. And then, so then I got a little hope. They interrogated me for 3 or 4 weeks, kept me in a little cage, sort of like a monkey or a lion, and fed me a little rice, and that was about all. And interrogated me every day, and asked me, how many carriers have you got in Pearl Harbor? When are the Americans going to use gas? Questions like this. And I found if I said I don't know, then I get, you know, this kind of treatment. So after a while, I'd say, well, we got 50 carriers in Pearl Harbor. You know, as long as I said something, it worked. One thing that probably gave me a little plausibility is they said, when are the Americans coming to Bougainville? I didn't know when they were coming to Bougainville. I said, soon. And I think they landed the next day on the other end of the island. So, of course, I didn't know that at the time.
Good guess.
At any rate, one thing that might have speeded up my evacuation from Bougainville was they said, what did you do when you were a civilian? I said, well, I was a sports reporter for the Boston Herald. I'd always been a sports fan, and since I never hadn't told them any truth up to then, I thought, well, might as well go along with this. And so that seemed to intrigue them. They got talking about baseball and Babe Ruth. And so they decided that maybe I was a valuable propaganda tool and they'd send me to Tokyo. At any rate, I was the last man that ever got out of Bougainville alive, so I think that might have possibly helped. So what they did is they took me down to the coast and the Americans came and bombed us while we were there. And I was quite pleased to see American planes, even though they were dropping bombs on us and strafing us. And every night we'd go 10 miles around the island in a little coastal vessel, 30 or 40 feet long, well, 50 feet maybe. And they'd hide it in the daytime. And gradually we worked our way up around to, we came to the northern part of Bougainville, which was called Ween. And on the way, I met a Marine pilot who had been tortured terribly. And we talked for about an hour. They took him away and killed him. So he was the first American that I'd seen. So when I got up to the top of Bougainville, I met another American. And they took us both out at night by a destroyer about midnight, took us to Rabaul. Well, this was the thing the hope that I'd lived on for several weeks was to get to this prison camp in Rabaul, which the Japs had told me there were many Americans there. And I thought, oh boy, if I could just see another American or another Christian, because the Japs were so alien to our way of thinking. They spit at me, they beat me, they kicked me, they treated me like a dog. And so I thought, if I could just see another American, I'd be willing to die, you know. That would be, so that's what I was looking forward to was Rabaul. Well, we came into Rabaul, and I was chagrined to see that there were still a lot of Japanese battleships, not battleships, but destroyers and other naval craft in the harbor. Many Japanese planes up in the skies. And they took me to this camp that had formerly been a tailor shop of the Japanese, of the Chinese. And there was divided into six little rooms. I mean, one tailor lived in each room. Well, now there were 10 or 12 Americans in each room. So that and the room was maybe, a little longer than this table and a little, maybe twice as wide. So that was where we were in Rabaul. And, but even so, being with the other Americans, when there was an air raid, we'd get out and we'd run to the air raid shelter, under custody, of course, and we'd talk to each other in whispers. And we all were assured that Rabaul was going to be invaded. That was going to be our salvation. The Americans were coming, and we were either going to be dead or liberated. So, if you ever look at military history, you'll find that there was a plan to invade Rabaul. But MacArthur and the Navy, in their wisdom, decided to bypass Rabaul, which was smart, because there were something like 80 or 100,000 Japanese under Britain. It would have been a bloody fight. And after they developed this hedgehopping theory of just going around and leaving the Japs to wither on the vine. Well, we were bombed some 2,000 times while I was in prison. And particularly in Rabaul, we were bombed. And one time around the 1st of March in 44, the Americans apparently had told the Japs that they were going to bomb Rabaul, maybe so they could evacuate civilians or people in hospitals. Because the Japs knew it was coming, because they put us in a very deep air raid shelter that we'd never been in before. When we came out of this air raid shelter, after we thought it was going to collapse, the dust was coming and the bombs were falling, the town was leveled. Everything was gone except for a few fires and Japs running around with bloody arms and bloody legs and all with bayonets on their rifles. And we didn't feel we were long for this world at that time. They took us out of Rabaul, took us up into the mountains and threw us into a cave that was about 4 feet high, maybe 20 feet long. They threw 63 of us in. Couldn't lie down. There wasn't room. You could just stand up. We were all handcuffed to each other, and we were there for 3 or 4 weeks. And during that time, they took some 20 of the people out one night, and then 20 the next. Those people all died. We think they murdered them, but we never knew for sure. And that left 23 of us, and at that point we were once again in despair. But we still had hope that the Americans were coming to liberate us, because we, with the bombing, we thought this was a prelude to the invasion. They moved us from the cave to another little shack up in the woods, where the 23 of us languished the rest of the war away. And about in the spring of 44, we realized after a few months that the Americans were not going to invade Rabaul, but that we'd been bypassed. And at that point, hope seemed to go out of a lot of the boys, and at a time when we were really being fed better than we had been, some 16 boys died in about 2 or 3 months. And this was in a room, one half the size of this room, maybe, or one third. So that left only 11 of us. And of these 11, I don't know why we had any more hope than the rest of them, but some of the ones that remained were quite resourceful, and they seemed to be, the older ones seemed to survive better than the real younger ones for some reason. At any rate, during the last year, only two boys of the 11 died of starvation. And the other two that died were died as a direct result of a Jap medical experiment. They injected five of us with blood from Japanese that were suffering from malaria. I think they thought we had developed an immunity. And two of the boys died. The doctor that injected us came back and said, "I'm sorry to hear you have malaria." So I brought you some Queenie. And the three of us who hadn't died, we recovered. So that left only seven of us. And I know at one point I had about given, run out my string, and I had about given up hope. And I used to pull a blanket over my head and just think about, you know, things like Westboro or the Westboro Country Club or the Westboro football team or my family or my girlfriend and stuff like that. And one of these guys from Australia named Murphy said, he used to taunt me. I won't say all the things he used to say because they're rather unspeakable, but at any rate, I'd throw the blanket off and I'd say, "God damn it, Murphy, if I ever get out of this, I'll kill you." I only weighed about 80 or 100 pounds. I couldn't throw a ball across the room. But he always says that he fanned that little spark of life that I had left. And I guess he did, because we've always been great friends. I've been over to New Guinea and Australia to see him a couple of times. And he came over here a couple of years ago when we had a reunion of the few of us that survived. To give you an idea of maybe why the Japs treat us this way, is they had this samurai code of Bushido, they call it. And the Bushido, you don't surrender. You fight till you're dead, or you commit harikiri. So anybody that was a prisoner was dishonorable. So they considered us as, people that would dishonor our country. Whereas Americans, our attitude is we fight as long as there's a chance. When there's no chance, you surrender. But that was perhaps why they treated us that way. With respect to our food, we had, I've told people, all the meat I had in a year I could put in that cup. It was mostly just rice and a few leaves, maybe, in the soup. No fish, no chicken. We had nothing like that. We had no medical attention whatsoever. We had no bathing, no way to bathe, no shower, no bath, no toothbrush, no soap. Those were just some of the things that you might be interested in. Now, I thought you might possibly like to hear the story of three of the boys that survived, because their tales were somewhat unique. Joe Holquin was a little Mexican kid from L.A. He was a navigator, a bombardier on a B-17. They were hit bombing Rabaul, and the plane started to go down. And he was the only one that was able to get out of the plane. And when he parachuted, he was so close to the ground, probably 500 feet or maybe less, I don't know, that he broke his back when he hit the ground. And the plane was everybody in the plane was gone. So Joe was crawling around there with his broken back. I guess he managed to eat a frog or two, and then the natives caught him. And he had a shrapnel hole through his chin. And he, the natives finally caught him and brought him in, and he became one of the pillars of strength of the community, you might say. He was very resourceful. He told the Japs he ran a sewing machine. So they brought an old Singer machine. They'd take him out of the shack, and he'd be out there in front of us, treadling on his machine, sewing up Japanese uniforms. He was a very resourceful guy. And we said, well, the reason you can survive on this, Joe, is all you ever had was tortillas and beans. Jim McMurray was a guy from South Carolina. His plane had been bombed. They actually dropped bombs, aerial bombs. The fighters flew over him and dropped these aerial bombs on the B-17 as he was limping back to Port Moresby. And he never got to Port Moresby. He and his crew put down in the water on a little island. They lived with the Kanaka natives, the Melanesians, for about 9 months. Then they decided they'd go ashore to the mainland and work their way over to Port Moresby. But when they got on shore, they were all captured. And so he didn't make it out of there, but he made it through prison camp. Now, John Murphy, the Australian I mentioned before, he was a coast watcher, which I always thought took more courage than the average. The fact is, as a pilot, I never envisioned anything like this. I thought, well, one good thing about being a pilot is you're either dead or you're living a good life. No in between, you know. So I was rudely awakened when I ended up with the Japs. But anyway, Murphy was a coast watcher. They landed him by submarine in behind the Jap lines with a fellow would escape from the Germans in Crete. So at any rate, somehow or other, they were betrayed by the natives and ambushed by the Japs. The fellow who had escaped from the Germans in Crete was killed, and Murphy was imprisoned. But when he came into prison camp, he didn't look like a prisoner. He always walked with a jaunty air, and he was never cowed by the Japanese. He always kept his bearing, and he was a very strong individual. In fact, as was Hoagland and McMurray. So to sum up our experiences, we alternated between despair and hope, but as long as you kept hope, you could survive. It seemed like no amount of physical or mistreatment or disease can conquer the human spirit if you have some hope. And that was what kept us alive. Now, I thought, since this is Veterans Day, I might speak a little about patriotism. I think patriotism, to me, is a very personal thing. I don't think it's nothing you can legislate for. You can't legislate patriotism any more than you can morality. Or religion, for that matter. And our government, at times, has tried to legislate patriotism, you might say. When we had this House on American Activities Committee, and then we had Senator McCarthy. Now, those people really did a disservice to the United States. They hid themselves behind the flag. How about Central America? And to be sure, the communists
it served their purposes to be opposed to the war in Vietnam. It served their purposes now to be opposed to America taking a strong stand in Central America. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people who are well-meaning and who I believe may be right in opposing our government. At least they should be heard without being condemned as Reds. Because now we know in the Vietnam War, which was a very unpopular war, that Nixon and Johnson tended to forget about the marches and everything. And you and I know that there were a lot of marches that we think should have been in jail or should never have been heard. But there were a lot of good people that thought our government was wrong. And I think that they were patriotic. I really do. And I found a quotation about that was written by Mr. Sumner as follows. My patriotism is the kind which is outraged by the notion that the United States was never a great nation until in a petty 3 months campaign it knocked to pieces a poor, decrepit, bankrupt old state like Spain. Now, of course, this was talking about the Spanish-American War. But I think that America had a couple of wars that weren't the greatest, the Mexican-American War and the Spanish-American War. And I think they were, that to oppose those wars was not to mean that you weren't patriotic. Now, finally, I'd like to say that I really thank the good Lord that this country has come to appreciate the veterans that served in the Vietnam War. They fought so valiantly, and they were treated so really shamefully by the country. So there's been, as you all have read, a great healing process, perhaps brought on by the wall down there in Washington. And I'm glad that they are perhaps now able to hold their head up and with some pride, because they certainly got the wrong end of the stick at one point. That's about all I have to say, Merrill. I'd be glad to answer anybody's questions. We've been here a long time, I know, and we took a long time to get fed here. So I don't want to hold anybody up any longer.
How about the Marianas?
The Peace Corps?
Yeah.
Well, my wife and I enjoyed our Peace Corps experience very much. As long as you don't think you're going to change the world. As long as you're willing to admit that the natives in the particular place you are don't want to be changed. Perhaps it was easier for us because we were mature. Of course, the Marianas was interesting to me because it was such a bloody World War II battle, and all the Japs, while we were in the Peace Corps, the Japs used to come back by droves to collect their ashes and have ceremonies, because some 30 or 40,000 Japs died on Saipan alone, as well as Guam and Tinian. And it was the place where, you may remember, whole Japanese families, because they had some civilians on the island too, were being pushed off these rocks. American boats were trolling down below with loudspeakers saying, "We won't kill you, don't jump." And the Japs kept going off the rocks, whole families, you know. And while we were there, there was an awful lot of armament still in the jungles out there. And I saw a lot of shells still active. In fact, every now and then the natives were always trying to dismember the bombs so they could dynamite the fish, and they were always getting blown up themselves.
Were you able to make friends with any one of the Japs?
Oh, yes. I didn't really hate the Japs when I got out. I never did, except for two or three that I would willingly have cut their throats. But, no, we had our friends amongst the guards, and you had to understand that beside this feeling, this Bushido code that they followed, they treated one another the same way. In other words, it would be nothing for a Jap corporal to a private, or throw him in jail, for that matter. They used to throw Japs in right in with us sometimes.
There were plants, or?
No, they just were punishing. Yeah. We probably smelled bad enough, so.
the Bushido code still lives. They applied it more to business.
Yeah. Now we've assisted our erstwhile enemies, Germany and Japan, are the strongest industrial countries in the world outside of the United States.
In fact, I was reading this book by this Australian who's taken prisoner of war, Japan Against the World, and claims that he was told by Japanese people that, military that he came in contact with officers, that Japan, the four-year war was only 4 years out of a 100-year war, and that they don't consider it really that their conquests really lost by that 4 year war. So they turn their energies to business, and this is the way they feel they're going to go. They want to be the industrial capital of the world.
Pretty good at it,
too. Yeah.
Never do it because they've got the same problem they had in World War II that brought us in. They have no oil.
Well, they were with America. When the Iranians said, if you don't go along with us, against America, they had the hostages. And up to that point, they said, we'd cut your oil off, the Iranians said. And so the Japanese, then again, switched sides to support the Iranians and cut their oil. So they take a quick change. What you do currently is the thought that they'd always be with us.
Well, things are fine as long as they are now, but when things get worse, and if they do, and the depression or anything else starts, it will be quickly solved when people in this country start bombing foreign cars.
Well, that's a possibility.
And they will.
I think we should give our speaker.
Absolutely.